Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 268 of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday to you, sir. How are you?
Doing awesome. Thanks for having me back.
Again, I went down the roster and I was looking at Paul, Ringo, George, and there's some drummer before. Let's see, who did I forget? None of them were available either. So we're back to you.
That's really sad.
Do you remember what the drum? Oh, see, someone already told me. Do you know what the drummer was for the Beatles before the drummer for the Beatles before Ringo?
I don't know other than Ringo.
Okay, there was a guy named, and I'm trusting that Al says it right. He says it's Pete Best. I knew that there was a drummer. And it's not like Ringo was that good of a drummer. I think he just continually showed up, kind of like us. Please make sure that you press all the likes and the subscribe buttons and leave reviews and do all those things to help have people find the podcast. It really does help ringing the bell and having thumbs up. You could definitely do the thumbs up, even if you don't want to subscribe. Thumbs up everything. And that helps share the program out to other people that may not know about it. Like this guy who we will be talking to in the future, but we're not there yet. He hadn't heard of the program before. It's really disturbing to me, Larry, that people haven't heard of us.
It really is disturbing since we've been at this, what, 5.5 years?
Something like that. Well, would you be so kind, sir, and give me a rundown for the show tonight? What are we going to talk about?
Well, we're going to have that person you just mentioned about just for a few minutes. We're going to be talking about moving your federal supervision from district to district around the country and some considerations. And we're going to be talking about a very recent case that was on this podcast on episode 267 from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals out of Michigan. You gave me so much grief about it, so I brought it back again. And then we've got a segment on Jeffrey Epstein. And then we've got a couple of articles, one from California, one from Connecticut.
So, Larry, I guess we'll move over to this section on transfer of federal supervised release. Do you want to set up the voicemail message from this individual?
Sure. We've got a person in California that's under lifetime supervised release, would like to move his supervision to the state of New Mexico. And he contacted New Mexico authorities and also the New Mexico advocacy. And I listened to the situation. I think it'd be helpful for our audience because we have a lot of people who have varying forms of federal supervision. Therefore, we're going to go into what this transfer process would look like and the considerations. So we're going to start with playing the voicemail.
All right, here we go.
Hi, my name is L. We just spoke over the phone. I have a conviction for an 18 U.S.C. 2252 possession of CP out of the Central District of California. My family is planning on moving to New Mexico, and yesterday I briefly spoke to she's a federal public defender at the public defender's office in Albuquerque. I called. She was the duty attorney of the day. I asked her a couple of questions about what supervision would be like there for me. She told me that usually for cases like mine, they don't give out any more than 5 years of supervised release. I currently have lifetime supervision by here in the Central District, and there's no end in sight. What she advised me is that if I were to move to New Mexico, that after a year to 2 years, I can petition to be removed, and it will very likely be done after I establish some trust within 1 year to 2 years. Rick advised me a little differently today, or the information he gave me, he didn't really advise me, was that, you know, he's never heard of anyone being terminated from lifetime supervision. This is separate from the registry. I'm not referring to the registry at all. I'm referring to federal supervised release, which is what I'm currently on, what I'm currently dealing with. Please give me a call back with any questions you may have. Thank you so much.
Well, there you go, Larry. Feel free.
All right. So, like I say, great question. And I'm going to try to dig into it with the limitations of my knowledge, which I'm not in federal practice in a large level. But I did some research. I did talk to a contract federal public defender in preparation. And it is true, he can transfer his supervision, and he can also transfer the jurisdiction of his case. So that judge that we didn't name that sentenced him could choose to relinquish the control over the case, and it would be assigned to a New Mexico federal judge. But the key word that was stressed to me and also appears to be in U.S. Code, 18 U.S. Code 3605, the transfer of jurisdiction, it is a may, not a shall, which I would interpret that as a non-attorney to mean that may is, it's an option. So therefore, if the judge in California allows the jurisdiction of the case to move, then he's going to be assigned to a judge here. I asked the public defender, and they said that it would be a random assignment. So we have no way of knowing which of the 8 or 9, 10 active federal judges that it would be assigned to. But say all that goes through and his jurisdiction is transferred to New Mexico. What's going to happen is the probation service, I agree with the public defender, the probation service is going to need to get comfortable with him, find out how he's responding to supervision here. But they're also going to look at the history of his supervision in the Middle District of California. They're going to be looking at any violations. They're going to be looking at his cooperation with treatment. They're going to be looking at his job stability. They're going to be looking at basically the whole file. The beautiful thing about federal probation is they have vastly more resources than most state systems. So therefore, the caseloads are small, and they're going to be looking at him with a fine-tooth comb. And so if we could have a little chat with the person, we will get into what I'd want to know. And I'd want to know first, is have there been any violations of the year? How many years has supervision been ongoing in the District of California, Middle District, and have there been any violations? So how long have you been under supervision?
So this next February here, in February 2024, I will have completed 5 years.
So you're just a few months past the four-year mark. And in terms of the number of violations, have there been any violations, and how many have there been, if there have been any?
Yes, I had one violation for travel in the end of 2021.
Okay, so you do have a violation. Well, my thoughts would be...
Yeah, that would be... I'm so sorry about that. It was the end of 2020. So I completed the 4 months of house arrest for the travel violation in April of 2021.
Okay, did you do any time in custody before the house arrest?
I did 36 months of federal custody. When I released in 2018 to a halfway house, October. I did 4 months and was released in February of 2019 into supervised release.
Okay. Well, I would say that based on the fact that you have had one violation, and that is generally looked at as a pretty significant violation in terms of travel. And was it out-of-state travel or was it out-of-county travel?
Yes, I traveled from California to Las Vegas, Nevada for a last-minute work trip.
So, well, if it was work-related, that which should serve as some mitigation versus if you did it just for pleasure. I won't get into the details of how you may have been apprehended in that or detected. But that was going to be certainly a negative. But you would want to have a part of the petition for removal, you'd want to have that clearly identified as being work-related, and hopefully you'd have some substantiation to show that it was work-related and not just because you felt like you needed some time off and you're going to give the middle finger to the PO. The feedback I've gotten is that the federal judges are largely very reasonable in this jurisdiction. So I'm not saying it's impossible to do, but lifetime supervision, I've got a potential client who wants off, and I shopped around for an attorney to represent him, and they did not. No, excuse me, it's not lifetime, it's 20-year supervised release he has. And he's like 6 years into it, and the attorney told me that based on the particular judge he has, will be which will not be named, it's not going to happen. So let's hope you don't get that particular judge. So, but yes, it's a good question, and I would say your odds, if you come here with only one violation and you've been stable for all the years you've been under supervision, you've got a decent chance, but then you've still got a lifetime registration obligation here in the state if you come here. And I think you understand that from pre-trial, from pre-show chat that I did with you, that the registration as it currently exists would be lifetime.
Yes, I do understand. Yes, unfortunately, there is no tier system in New Mexico.
So, well, not an official one. There are terms of registration that are less than lifetime, but it's not because of any type of tier system. It's based on how the law existed at the time of those offenses and those convictions. And there's so many nuances that would take a long time to explain. But and the situation you're in with the age of your offense being relatively new, you would be in the category, since we take the categorical approach, you would be in the category of lifetime under present law.
Yes, I understand.
So, is that any way helpful to you? But I really do appreciate the question. I thought it was a good one.
Yes, it is very helpful. I appreciate your time and answering my question.
Is there anything else you'd like to ask us?
Not really, no. You guys keep up the good work.
Well, I got a question. Have you heard of the podcast prior to this?
No, I hadn't.
Ah.
My family and my fiance, are extremely interested in New Mexico because of its culture and heritage and how deep-rooted, especially with the indigenous, it is. They want to move. My parents want to retire, and my fiance, we want to open up another branch of our business in New Mexico for filming. And Albuquerque is a place of interest for us, and we've seriously considered there. And to me, as stringent as state registry is at the current moment, what I have to deal with currently here in the Central District is no end in sight. And when I say no end in sight, any attorney I've spoken to, any and all attorneys, which I've lost count, maybe over 100, give me the answer. I don't know. And my judge, he's going to keep me on for as long as possible. I can't even file for motions for modification, regardless of how far they infringe on my civil liberties, even though they're unrealistic, especially for my low-level offense. It's been extremely difficult to survive in Southern California, if I can explain that to you. People who don't have restrictions are already struggling and moving in droves into other states. So, I called to poke around a little bit with the duty public defender, and it's nice to hear that there's at least one district in the country that is, comes from a logical approach versus just focused on punitive, fear-based punishment.
So, Larry, haven't there been changes with California somewhat recently? Like, there was something where they can get off the registry if you're born on this date with the full moon and super narrowly
Well, I think, as I understand it, his offense is still a Tier 3 in California, which would limit that option, but he's more worried about the federal
Okay.
supervised release. And then there is some talk of reducing the simple possession down to possibly a Tier 2 or maybe even a Tier 1, which is where it belongs by the AWA standards. It should be a Tier 1. So, but all right.
Gotcha.
Well, it's good for you to drop in on short notice.
No problem.
So, yeah,
Well, have a great night.
there's so much traffic going by. It's kind of distracting, but appreciate you coming in.
Not a problem. Thank you so much.
Well, very good. Let's see here. So, where should we go? I guess we'll jump into this Jeffrey Epstein thing. Yeah, we'll go there.
You want to do Jeffrey Epstein? Well, let's do Jeffrey Epstein. What do you want to
All
talk
right.
about, Mr. Epstein?
Well, I did find an article from the AP News about Mr. Epstein, and nearly, God, I can't believe it's been 4 years, though, Larry, that the AP has obtained more than 4,000 pages of documents from the Federal Bureau of Prisons under the Freedom of Information Act. They include a detailed psychological reconstruction of the events leading to his suicide, as well as his health history, internal agency reports, emails, memos, and other records. And so let's dig into this a little bit.
Well, I know that there's still a feeding frenzy going on out there because there's a lot of money supposedly in his estate. So the feeding will cease when the money is gone.
Tell me, what I know he's listed as a quote-unquote financier. What does he do? What was his job?
I don't really understand what he did, but he went around the world doing it and apparently buying real estate and making lots of money.
It's like it seems that what his job was that he like fabricated money out of thin air and robbed Peter to pay Paul. Not necessarily rob, but created money out of thin air and became wealthy that way. That's what it seems. But so to set this up, Epstein arrived at the Metropolitan Correctional Center on July 6, 2019. He spent 22 hours in the jail's general population before officials moved him to the special housing unit due to the significant increase in media coverage and awareness of his notoriety among the inmate population, according to the psychological reconstruction of his death. Do you have any issues with them putting him in special housing?
I do. A person who has to be put in special housing for their own safety, in my opinion, should not suffer the diminution of privileges and be treated like they've broken prison rules, because that's a thing that they use for people who are non-cooperative. If the prison decides it can't keep you safe because there are vultures in there, in my opinion, you should have no diminution of privileges because it's not really your fault that you're a celebrity. So I do have a little bit of problem that it's not his fault that he was receiving not just national, but even global publicity.
Well, would you tell me what the alternative was? I mean, they only have so many resources. And if you show up with your entourage, not an entourage, but all of a sudden now you have an entourage and this entourage in prison wants to kill you. What are they supposed to do?
Well, no, I'm saying the special housing unit is okay, but there's no diminution of privileges.
So he still should get store call and yard call and whatever else, phone calls?
Yes, he should be treated. It's kind of like the same feeling and position I have about pretrial custody. You're supposedly presumed innocent, right?
That's the thought.
All right. So when a jail is running people in custody, it would seem like to me if you're presumed innocent versus someone who has already pled or been convicted and is sitting there waiting to go to state or federal prison, they're in their punishment phase. You're not in your punishment phase yet because you're presumed innocent. So therefore, there should be a much more liberalized treatment for you in terms of access to things, administratively held. Well, that's the way I feel about Epstein with a special housing unit. If he is a celebrity and the prison feels like it can't keep him safe, there's no need to diminish him in any way in terms of his privileges because he's a special management problem, but not by his own fault. If he's throwing feces on the guards, then he's a special he's a special management problem that deserves disciplinary segregation.
I see your point, though. The documents reveal that Epstein later said he was upset and complained about being treated like he was the bad guy, despite being well-behaved behind bars. He requested a brown uniform for his near-daily visits with his lawyers rather than the orange jumpsuit he had been issued. Let's go through some of the key points of the article. It says that 2 weeks before ending his life, Jeffrey Epstein sat in a corner of his Manhattan jail cell with his hands over his ears, desperate to muffle the sound of a toilet that would not stop running. So, that sounds horrible. Did the BOP deliberately ignore his needs?
It certainly would look that way and appear that way. And I'm assuming this AP story is well-researched and true. So we're just simply going along with the story, folks.
If we go look at our media bias chart, they are listed as the most center and most accurate of all news out there. The article also states that Epstein was agitated and unable to sleep, according to records newly obtained by the Associated Press. He called himself a coward and complained he was struggling to adapt to life behind bars. The disgraced financier was under psychological observation at the time of a suicide attempt just days earlier that left his neck bruised and scraped. Yet, even after a 31-hour stint on suicide watch, Epstein insisted he wasn't suicidal, telling a psychologist he had a wonderful life and would be crazy to end it. But he did on August 10th of 2019.
Well, the documents AP obtained Thursday provide the most complete accounting to date of Epstein's detention and death and his chaotic aftermath. The records helped to dispel many of the conspiracy theories, and man, there have been a lot of them surrounding his suicide, underscoring how fundamental failings at the Bureau of Prisons, including severe staffing shortages and employees cutting corners, contributed to Epstein's death. Remember, he was also presumed innocent. He was pretrial.
In one email, a prosecutor involved in Epstein's criminal case complained about a lack of information from the Bureau of Prisons in the critical hours after his death, writing that it was frankly unbelievable that the agency was issuing a public press release before telling us basic information so that we can relay it to his attorney, who can relay it to his family. What do you make of that information?
Well, I would say the prosecutor had some dignity and wanted to treat the family with some level of respect, which, you know, kudos to the prosecutor for being irritated about that.
The article also states in another email, a high-ranking Bureau of Prisons official made a spurious suggestion to the agency's director that news reporters must have been paying jail employees for information about Epstein's death because they were reporting details of the agency's failings, impugning the ethics of journalists and the agency's own workers. What do you make of that kind of claim?
Well, I would not rule out the possibility that news reporters may have been paying for information. After all, it's a very competitive business, and being first is important. The documents also provide a fresh window into Epstein's behavior during his total 36 days in jail, including his previously unreported attempt to connect by mail to another high-profile Federal Bureau of Prison resident named Larry Nassar. Do you remember Larry Nassar?
I believe I've heard of him.
Yes, that was the gymnastics team doctor convicted of sexually abusing dozens, if not scores, of athletes.
Right. And then the night before Epstein's death, he excused himself from a meeting with his lawyers to make a telephone call to his family. According to a memo from a unit manager, Epstein told a jail employee that he was calling his mother, who oddly had been dead for 15 years at that point. That does sound bizarre that he wanted to call his mother if she was already dead.
Well, now, remember, from what we said above, he was in a very tough environment where he was undergoing chronic noise torture. And what do they call it? Psychological psyops.
And yeah, totally.
He could have been out of his head due to the conditions at that correctional facility, or he may have lied to the staff. Who knows? But it does sound very bizarre, I'll agree.
The article states that Epstein's death put increased scrutiny on the Bureau of Prisons and led the agency to close the Metropolitan Correctional Center in 2021. That sounds at least like something positive that may have come out of this.
Yes. I didn't even realize until I saw this article that they had closed that facility. But the article also states that it spurred an AP investigation that has uncovered deep, previously unreported problems within the agency. The Justice Department's largest, with more than 30,000 employees, 158,000 inmates, and an $8 billion annual budget. An internal memo, undated, but sent after Epstein's death, attributed problems at the jail to seriously reduced staffing levels, improper or lack of training, and follow-up and oversight. The memo also details steps the Bureau of Prisons has taken to remedy lapses Epstein's suicide exposed, including requiring supervisors to review surveillance video to ensure officers made the required checks. Now, can you imagine having to remind people that, we have a policy when we put you on suicide watch. Now, by the way, we need to remind you that logging these checks are important, that you actually do them. Don't just enter them in the log. Can you imagine having to have a retraining for that?
It seems that if you were a guard in the suicide watch area taking care of those kinds of checks, that kind of would be your fundamental charge.
Well, you wouldn't think you would need additional training. This is a suicide watch you're on. We've got to keep a good eye on these people because we don't want to lose them to an untimely death. I don't think you'd have to train people to do that.
I'll tell you, at least the first place that I was at, like, you're bored as hell in there anyway. And I'm like, where could you put something? I couldn't see any place that you could hang something that you could hang from. The bunks were just attached to the wall, and the bottom bunk was just like a concrete slab, but there were no sharp edges that you could tie anything to. And even if you could then get it tied to it, like, unless you're 4 feet tall, you're not tall enough to hang or short enough to hang from it to do any damage. So I'm very puzzled as to how somebody could do this in there, but this is a different facility, so I don't know.
Well, apparently it worked.
Clearly it did work, unless you want to go with the conspiracy theories that somebody else did it for him. Epstein's lawyer, Martin Weinberg, said people detained at the facility endured medieval conditions of confinement that no American defendant should have been subjected to. It said, "It's tragic that it took this kind of event to finally cause the Bureau of Prisons to close this regrettable institution." Weinberg said Thursday in a phone interview, "Did anyone face charges related to Epstein's death, Larry?"
Yes, they did. The workers who were tasked with guarding him the night he killed himself, the names were provided by AP, Tova Neal and Michael Thomas, were charged with lying on prison records to make it seem as though they had done the required checks before Epstein was found lifeless. Prosecutors alleged they were sitting at their desks just 15 feet from Epstein's cell, shopped online for furniture and motorcycles, and walked around the unit's common area instead of making the required rounds every 30 minutes.
I see that. And it also says, during 1 2-hour period, both appeared to have been asleep, according to their indictment. Noel and Thomas admitted to falsifying the log entries, but avoided prison time under a deal with federal prosecutors. Copies of some of those logs were included among the documents released Thursday, with the guards' signatures redacted. This is terrible. What do you think drove him to suicide?
Well, the article states that his outlook worsened when a judge denied him bail on July 18th. I would imagine he was hopeful that the system would treat him as a presumed innocent, but he had forgotten about the Bail Reform Act of 1984. But anyway, that raised the prospect that he was going to remain locked up until he had trial and possibly, of course, being sent away for many years. They said if he was convicted, he was facing 45 years in prison. So 4 days later, Epstein was found on the floor of his cell with a strip of bedsheet around his neck. This means the BOP clearly knew he was deteriorating. They knew that he was deteriorating.
Those injuries didn't require going to the hospital. He was placed on suicide watch and later psychiatric observation. Jail officers noted in logs that they observed him sitting at the edge of his bed, lost in thought, and sitting with his head against the wall. During an initial screening, medical records showed he was suffering from sleep apnea, constipation, hypertension, lower back pain, and prediabetes, as well as other things. He was certainly not in great health, and prison health care sucks to say the least. And I don't know what kind of food he was eating, Larry, but good grief. Prison food is not, I forget even like school level lunches. I mean, this is not gourmet food. This is some garbage, like a piece of suspect bologna and 2 pieces of white bread, some kind of like canned peaches, stuff like that. It's really not the best of diet. So he could be constipated because of the change of diet.
Well, I would agree that prison food is not good. I'm told that in the federal system, because of the vastly improved resource level, that the food is somewhat better, but it may vary dramatically from prison to prison. But they did say that Epstein made attempts to adapt to his jailhouse surroundings. He signed up for a kosher meal and told prison officials through his lawyer he wanted permission to exercise outside. 2 days before he was found dead, Epstein bought $73.85 worth of items from the prison commissary, including an FM radio. Oh, an AM/FM radio. My
God. Oh, yeah, man.
And he had $566 on his commissary account when he died. Would you please explain what a kosher meal is?
Generally, kind of speaking, kosher would be, it could be also for Muslims, but for Jews, it's going to be specially prepared. It's going to be higher quality in general. From the prison point of view, what would they do? Kosher meat, so probably like no pork, obviously. And if they're preparing it right, Larry, dairy and meat can't cross paths. If you remember Ghostbusters where they cross the streams, you can't cross the streams with dairy and meat. and some other things. Like, it just has to be prepared in a specific kind of way to be kosher.
All right.
And somebody says, and they just heat them up in the prison kitchen. So maybe they're outsourced, like a, you know, like a Hungry Man kind of frozen dinner, but it's not, it's just going to be different than what the normal food is. Epstein expressed frustration with the noise of the jail and lack of sleep. His first few weeks at the Metropolitan Correctional Center, he didn't have his sleep apnea breathing apparatus he used. Then the toilet in his cell started acting up, and he was still left in the same cell with a broken toilet. The jail's chief psychologist wrote in an email the next day, please move him to a cell next door when he returns from legal, as the toilet still does not work. This certainly sounds like neglect to me.
Well, it certainly sounds that way to me as well, but good luck getting anything done about it. The day before Epstein ended his life, a federal judge unsealed about 2,000 pages of documents in the sexual abuse lawsuit against him. This probably was the point of no return. But in terms of the neglect, you know, we're going to get into a segment later about getting compensation for damages. And I think that's going to be a long shot if anybody were to try it on Epstein's behalf. Since he's perceived as being rich, it's going to be kind of hard to get taxpayers to say, oh, well, yes, we mistreated him. Of course we want to pay him a little money. I think that's a long shot.
And also, since he's kind of not really living to receive the funds, why would they support a claim like that?
Well, if he had heirs, possibly. But like I said, I just don't think there's going to be a lot of sympathy among any jury pool. Doesn't matter where you pull the jurors from.
Can I pull a little bit of devil's advocate with you on this particular thing of them moving him?
Sure.
So let's say he's in a unit with 20 rooms, and it's one-person rooms because of the conditions he's in. You can't put somebody in a room with someone else if you're being, like, threatened with your life. So there's potentially 20 people in this housing unit, and if all of the rooms are full and this toilet is broken, hey, move him to another room. There is no other room unless you swap him with someone else. And boy, does that put you on somebody's shit list if you swap with someone and now they're in your room with the running toilet and they can't get any sleep. So couldn't this just be an institutional limitation that there's no place else to put him?
It certainly could have been. That wasn't revealed in the investigation till the very end, where the part you read about, there was apparently an open cell next to him. But it's always a problem for jail administrators when they're trying to figure out where to put people, because there's so many things that can generate special needs. And you don't have enough housing available oftentimes because of overcrowding. So I don't know that they had any other options, but it sounds like they did.
Mm-mm. All right. Well, I guess we will close out the Epstein email, or not email, the article. Shall we move over to this feature segment, the Sixth Circuit case from Michigan?
Well, the article did mention that there was another investigation by the Department of Justice, Inspector General, and it's still ongoing. So who knows where this will end up, but thankfully, the facility is closed, and no one else will go through that at that facility anyway.
And they'll just move the bad facility to someplace else. Like, if that's the worst of the worst, there's still a second place worst.
Absolutely.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right, well, on episode 265, we spent half the program talking about a case before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the court had just heard oral arguments, and now you want to circle back less than a month later. What is the fascination that you have with this case, Larry?
Because the case has already been decided. That's why.
Well, that's pretty simple. So should we just press stop and go home now?
Well, probably not.
So you said there's already a decision now?
I did indeed say that. There has already been a decision. You remember all the grief you gave me on that episode about Mr. Doom and Gloom and all that stuff. So yes, there's already been a decision.
Hang on, I'm going to put the picture up there for you. Yes, you are Mr. Doom and Gloom. If it's not even a month, like the Supreme Court takes 9 months from hearing oral arguments to them making decisions in the summertime. This seems like it would also be pretty fast on the turnaround.
I'd say it's one of the fastest, if not the fastest turnaround I have ever seen.
Let's remind the audience what this case was about. The plaintiffs sought damages from high-ranking Michigan officials alleging that they oversaw and failed to stop the police's unconstitutional actions. The district court dismissed the complaint on various grounds, including sovereign immunity and the plaintiff's appeal to the Sixth Circuit. And what did the Sixth Circuit decide? These are like tongue twister words, Larry. Can't they make these words better?
Well, I could have tried, but they decided that the district court properly granted the motion to dismiss because the plaintiffs had failed to state a claim of supervisory liability.
You were definitely Mr. Doom and Gloom, as you discussed in this case on RM265. In fact, we got grief about that. Let me cue up. I have a little bit of a clip from the episode that we played somewhere around minute 31 of the show. So what you're about to hear is me in the past. It'll probably sound almost identical, so you won't know that it's me in the past, but it's me from a month ago. Going along, Senior U.S. Circuit Court Judge Danny Boggs, a Ronald Reagan appointee, pointed out much of the complaint filed by Matuka's clients was written in the passive voice, and they asked the attorney why the individuals who directly enforced the registration requirements were not named as defendants. That turns into a whack-a-mole problem, Matuka said. No one from the top of the authority with the authority to do so said, this needs to stop or this is unconstitutional. Was this a failure or a bad strategy?
Not sure I can say with my limited information, but I can say that for whether it was bad strategy, it's going to probably result in an outcome that we're not going to be happy with. It's going to surprise me if they turn this around.
You know, that sounded just like you, Larry.
It did, and it reminds me of how bad I sounded before I switched microphones. But yes, that is what I said. I said all throughout that episode, each one of the claims they had, that they couldn't turn them around because of a number of factors. And so here we are, a month later, talking about this case again that's been decided.
All right. Well, let me provide a bit more background on the case before we dig into the appeal. On August 17th of 2021, John Doe's 1 through 5, five Michigan PFRs filed their complaint in this class action lawsuit. They sued Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, former Michigan Governor Richard Snyder, Joseph Gaspar, the current MSP director, and Christy Etu, the former MSP director, seeking damages under 42 U.S. Code, subsection 1983. The plaintiffs allege that the MSP enforced unconstitutional provisions of SORA against them from 2006 onwards, including after Doe's 1, Doe's 1 on appeal, and Doe's 2 were decided. And they allege that the defendants, whom they purport to sue in their individual capacities, knew that the invalidated provisions were unconstitutional but failed to stop their subordinates from enforcing them against the plaintiffs. Does that pretty much cover it?
It does, other than that they wanted money. The plaintiffs claimed that they were subjected to due process violations, retroactive punishments, and First Amendment infringement, and they suffered significant economic loss and emotional harm.
The plaintiffs argued that all defendants are individually liable for constitutional violations resulting from the MSP's enforcement of SORA. They asserted that, despite having knowledge of the violations, defendants failed to issue any directive, policy memoranda, or other form of communication instructing its subordinates that the enforcement of 2006 and 2011 amendments was unconstitutional. I remember that you weren't super impressed with the attorney's work in this case. What irked you the most?
The same thing that continues to irk me. Sloppy litigation. They stated in their complaint, they, quote, believe defendants encouraged and implicitly authorized the continued violations of plaintiffs' rights by the MSP and other law enforcement agencies. As I stated on that previous episode, 267, that's a problem. It's not enough to believe something. They need to prove what they believe. And they did not prove their assertion, and it's difficult to prove things when you don't have a trial.
This doesn't come down to a summary judgment thing, does it?
It does not. It came down to a 12B6 motion under federal rules to dismiss for failure to state a claim. When you draft a complaint, the complaint on that motion to dismiss, everything is assumed true in the complaint. And then based on what the allegations are, there has to be a credible likelihood that, let me see how to word this correctly because it's not in the script, but there has to be plausible that you would win at trial. And they get the benefit of the doubt that what they pled was true. But when you put in your complaint that you believe something, that's not good enough. The complaint should have said, upon information and belief, it's okay when you've got information and belief, Sergeant John Doe of the Macomb County Sheriff's Department, despite being warned, was adamant that he was going to continue to enforce the registry. Then the judge, looking at the motion to dismiss, is going to say, well, wait a minute. If they can prove that Sergeant John Doe of the Macomb County Sheriff's Department did that, this is basis for this claim to go forward. But when you put state in there that you believe something, that's not good enough.
I mean, I don't want to nitpick, Larry, for real. Are you saying one word swayed this litigation?
No, there was plenty of problems with this litigation, but that was one that stood out the most at me, that irked me that they put in there. But there was plenty of things wrong with this litigation.
And why would you put believe? I mean, like, on such and such date, John Doe, Sergeant John Doe, did these things, and the statute says he should do these things instead. I mean, that's not a belief. That's here's A and here's B, where you're comparing, and A is the right way and B is the wrong way, the way it was being done, and here's what the law says. Well, it doesn't sound like that would be that hard to prove.
Well, except they didn't allege that in the complaint. They didn't allege that. They needed to identify with precision who was giving the orders, who had a, that's going to require you to do a little bit of work. These people were rushing because they're wanting to do a little bit of ambulance chasing to get onto the Sixth Circuit gravy train that the ACLU had won. And they had clients tell them, hey, I've lost millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars because of this. And rather than doing what I would have done, I'd have said, well, okay, show me what money you lost. Well, I didn't get a job. Show me that you didn't get that job because of the registry. What proof do you have you didn't get that job because of the registry? Well, I don't have any, but everybody knows I didn't get the job because of the registry. No, everybody doesn't know that. You could have not gotten the job because you're a lousy employee. You could have not gotten the job because you had bad breath. You could have not gotten the job because they didn't like your attitude at the interview. You've got to have proof you didn't get the job. And of course, they would have gone down the street and hired somebody else if they'd interviewed me, and they'd have said, that's the guy's biggest a-hole I've ever run into, and I wouldn't have got the job. But that's the kind of thing that goes wrong in this type of litigation. You know, they told the people what they wanted to hear. I just said the just opposite. You're trying to get damages from the governor? What proof do you have that the governor did anything? The governor didn't even think about the registry.
I'm thinking of there's a YouTube video out there of a guy, a PFR, calling different apartment complexes and flat out saying, hey, I'm on the registry. Would you rent to me? And they're like, you know, probably not. So you could then, that would be your information to bring into court going, I didn't get housing because of this. There would be your hard evidence of a recorded phone call conversation with the person at the apartment complex.
Well, it would get you started. But with me, if I'm on the defense side of that, it's not going to get you very far because I'm going to say this could be a hoax. What's the name of that apartment that you called? Who's the person you talked to? What is their policy? Yeah, you could have called your next door neighbor and had that conversation recorded.
I'm with you. But as far as like the job thing, if you put in an application and no one calls you back, there's 500 different reasons why they didn't call you back. One of which could be the registry.
It very well could be, but it's your responsibility to have proof of that. This case was void of any proof. They threw everything up, seeing if something would stick. And like I say, the governor of Michigan never has thought about the registry. It would have no idea how it works.
Oh my God, didn't we talk about a case a couple of years ago where there were like 67 points that we went through? Do you remember that?
I'm sure we've talked about cases with many, it was 67 points or even more, but.
All right. The trial court identified several issues with the complaint when it was dismissed. There was the issue with the statute of limitations, sovereign immunity, and qualified immunity. And I ask you, if they could recover, you stated, extremely unlikely. It appears that Mr. Doom and Gloom was correct. I recall that sovereign immunity was an issue. Tell us about that.
Well, it was an issue, and it's very confusing. The state defendants urged the Sixth Circuit to affirm the district court dismissal on sovereign immunity grounds. And sovereign immunity is a doctrine that bars official capacity suits for damages, but not individual capacity suits for damages. And that's way too complicated for me to explain. And the court even agreed. It said, we need not to wade into this swamp. However, because of a close reading of the plaintiff's complaint, it makes clear that the plaintiffs have failed to state a claim against the defendants in their individual capacities. Again, more sloppy litigation. You've got to succinctly identify how you're suing the person in their official or their individual capacity. And that is a gray area. And I am not sufficiently good at explaining individual versus official capacity. And the courts chose to sidestep it because they didn't plead it out correctly to begin with. Sloppy work, guys, sloppy work.
The issue that was most important was supervisory control. The plaintiffs sought to hold the defendants liable on a theory of supervisory liability. They alleged that the defendants knew that SORA was unconstitutional, but failed to stop their subordinates from enforcing the statute against the plaintiffs. You didn't like that claim either. Why not?
Well, according to the Sixth Circuit, to state a claim of supervisory liability under subsection 1983, plaintiffs must plausibly allege that a defendant authorized, approved, or knowingly acquiesced in the unconstitutional conduct of his subordinates through the execution of the job functions. To survive a motion to dismiss, a plaintiff must plausibly allege active unconstitutional behavior, which goes beyond a mere failure to act. Sloppiness, recklessness, or negligence is insufficient to establish liability. You guys can sit around and drink your coffee all night long, and you can think that the governor was thinking about this. She never thought about the registry. Running a state as a chief executive has a lot of moving parts, and the registry is the last thing on anybody's mind when it comes to running the state. She never thought about it. You didn't have any smoking gun that pointed toward the governor. You should have, rather than trying to be impressive and get a lot of publicity, that we sued the governor and the chief of the Michigan State Police. You should have tried to identify someone who knew it was unconstitutional and mentioned that person by name and said, this person gave the order to do this, despite knowing about the legal decisions that had already come forward that called this whole thing into question. But you didn't do that. You went for the gusto.
The court then stated the plaintiffs do not plausibly allege that the defendants authorized, approved, or knowingly acquiesced in any unconstitutional conduct. The plaintiffs allege that Atu and Gaspar knew that their subordinates were violating the plaintiff's constitutional rights, but failed to intervene, and that this failure encouraged the implicitly authorized and implicitly authorized the alleged constitutional violations. How did the court respond to that one?
They responded, failing to intervene is not the same as affirmatively granting authorization. That leaves theories of liability that include knowing acquiescence, implicit authorization, and deliberate indifference. To show that Etu and Gaspar had knowledge of the alleged constitutional violations, the plaintiffs pointed to the decision in Doe's 1 and Doe's 1 on appeal and Doe's 2. But Doe's 1 and Doe's 1 on appeal establish only that Michigan had violated four individual plaintiffs' rights and not that the Michigan State Police was continued to violate the rights of other PFRs. And a final judgment of Doe's 2s didn't come about to August 4th, 2021. And that was after the Michigan legislature had amended SORA to remove the challenge provisions. They also stated while Etu and Gaspar oversaw the Michigan State Police, many of the complaints allegations appear to be targeted at behavior of local law enforcement, which MSP directors do not supervise. If you had bothered to have done any work, you would have been able to have ascertained that the sheriff and local police don't answer to the state police. The plaintiff's allegations of knowledge thus cross the line from being conceivable to plausible only barely, if at all, according to the court.
The plaintiffs allege that the governors were aware of their subordinates and continued to enforce the invalidated portions of SORA, not least because the governors were subject to a never-ending barrage of lawsuits. Why was that not compelling, do you think?
Well, he merely prevented the retroactive application of SORA to the four individual plaintiffs, and neither opined on whether Michigan was unconstitutional applying the amendments to other PFRs nor indicated that the Michigan State Police could continue to do so in the future. That case did not definitively determine that any portion of SOAR was unconstitutional. This is according to the court. And that decision, those two, which granted class-wide relief, became final only after the Michigan legislature had already removed the offending parts of SOAR. And so thus, despite the plaintiff's assertions to the contrary, this case is different from the cases that they cited, which were Petros, and I forget the other one, and where they alleged that the supervisor had been warned repeatedly of a pattern of constitutional violations. And the court says, we do not say the plaintiffs can never plausibly allege knowing acquiescence or deliberate indifference by pointing to a pattern of past or ongoing litigation, but the three decisions the plaintiffs cite and their complaint are insufficient.
I see. So if you could have re-rolled this whole thing, what would you have done to make it more gooder?
Well, gee,
I know you said evidence.
I would. Well, first of all, I'd been much more confrontational with the people wanting to do the litigation, which drives them up the wall. But I have to tell them, look, I'm going to put myself on the defense side of this. And this is what I'm going to argue if I'm defending the state of Michigan. And if I can think of this, I'm sure they're at least as smart as I am. And here's what I'm going to argue. Some basic research by the trial judge's law clerk uncovered these decisions, Petros and whatever the other one was. And all this stuff was very basic research. And if you are not capable of doing basic research before you launch a constitutional claim, then you probably ought not be practicing in this area of law. But what I would have done would have been to do extensive research on what the case law has already been decided that's binding. And I would have told the people unequivocally, you've got to have evidence. Who did these things to you? How much money did you lose? And what caused you to lose it? What have you got in the way of evidence? Your theory is not enough. The fact that you don't have lots of money does not necessarily mean that the registry precluded you from having lots of money. You may be a loser all across the board.
I'm with you. All right. Anything else that you want to say closing this one out?
No, but I have detected some dropouts, so I hope we have good audio tonight.
I only detected one just a second ago. So we'll see. And no local copy. Yay. Do you want to cover this Oklahoma budget legislature shenanigans?
Sure. Oh, that was just a brief one. The state of Oklahoma legislature just approved a general fund spending plan that increases the next fiscal year, starting July 1st, by 20% over the previous fiscal year. Now, would you say that Oklahoma is a state governed by the collection of liberals, or would you say it's more conservative?
I would definitely lean that in the right direction.
Well, now, how is it that a fiscally responsible state like Oklahoma can increase spending by 20% in 1 year, and then their neighboring state of New Mexico increases it by 12.6%, and we're doing runaway spending because we're under Democratic administration, and we increase our budget by 12%, and they increase theirs by 20%. Can you explain that difference there?
20 is definitely smaller than 12.
Oh, okay. Now that explains it. I would be curious within the 20%, who got the bulk? Which agencies got the bulk? My guess would be prisons, law enforcement, courts, anything related to being tough on crime. I seriously doubt that very much of that money went to human services unless it was responding to deficiencies that had been shown by litigation, like when the Kansas Supreme Court said that they were underfunding education after they did their big tax cuts several years ago. And they were going to show us how to make an economy boom. And then they were underfunding the constitutional requirement to provide children in Kansas an education. And they had to come back and increase their taxes to pay for their spending. But I'm just doubting that very much of that went to human needs.
Probably not. Yeah, I guess that one was kind of quick. Do you want to cover one more? I want to cover this. Taxpayers end up paying for Joe Arpaio's legal fees.
Well, now that's funny.
First of all, who's Joe Arpaio? God, what a dick.
Well, you can't say that on a family program.
Joe Arpaio is like the 50-year presiding sheriff over like Phoenix area, right? Maricopa County?
That is correct. He was a sheriff out there in Maricopa County for a long time. He ran for United States Senate. Fortunately, he didn't do so well. And then he He did a lot of stuff that was questionably illegal, including running his own immigration enforcement, and he got convicted for contempt of court. A judge held him in contempt, and then the former president pardoned him for that. So therefore, he didn't have to pay any penalty for his contempt because he was pardoned by the president at that time. But the article is taxpayers at Metro Phoenix are approaching a milestone in their financial pain. 2013, the bill is expected to reach $273 million by the summer of 2024, officials were told Monday before they approved a tentative budget of $38 million in legal and compliance spending for the racial profiling lawsuit. Now, you have to admit that that's funny.
That's amazing. And tell me what he is famous for.
Well, he took great pride. He liked being in the media. So he would do things that would draw attention to him, like keeping the cost of running his jail very low. He would pride himself in keeping the cost of meals to $1.12 a day by feeding them green bologna and junk food that was very inexpensive. And he had them wear pink underwear because the jail would be losing underwear that they would take with them. So they made the underwear pink, and of course, not too many. No, very few men are very fond of taking pink underwear with them anywhere. So he did things like that, which is designed to humiliate. And he put people in tents in the desert heat over there. He put people in tents.
He also run hot water in the hot tents?
I don't think I remember that, but I wouldn't put anything past Joe. I'm pretty sure
that's what he did, is he had the showers had hot water even in the desert in the summertime.
But what people don't understand when they're talking about stuff like this, it sounds good when he says, I'm keeping my cost of feeding prisoners down to $1.12 a day, and all every other county in Arizona spending $32 a day or whatever it is. You know, that sounds really good to an average citizen. But the problem, what you don't see, is the invisible cost. And I was having that discussion today with a person in Texas. There was a legislative proposal to air condition the state prisons in Texas, and of course it went nowhere. And the person said, Larry, I can't understand why that didn't pass. I said, well, I can't understand why you can't understand why it didn't pass. It's easy to understand why it didn't pass. Well, okay, well, explain it to me. I said, well, the cost for air conditioning the prisons, those are upfront costs that's going to have to be paid now. So if we go on a building binge and we could take whatever number of units that are in Texas prisons that are not air conditioned and ventilated properly, we're going to have costs that have to be appropriated now. If we look at all the invisible costs related to staff outages, inmates being taken to hospital care in the dead of heat because of heat-related illnesses, those costs materialize later, and they can be kind of shoved aside. So therefore, it's very easy to understand if you look at it open-minded. Okay, if I'm going to have to come up with $190 million to retrofit the prisons, it may be a long time before I spend $190 million in little chunks to pay for all the downsides of not having proper ventilation. It's hard to calculate what the morale reduction is of the people who can't perform their jobs adequately. It's hard to calculate all that stuff. It's probably going to be greater than $190 million, but I've got to come up with $190 million now, but I've also got all the agencies all over Texas asking me for appropriations. And when I go out on the campaign trail, when I say I was able to do this for the citizens of Texas, you just don't get a lot of votes when you say, and I was able to get $190 million to ventilate and air condition our state prisons. That just doesn't gain you a lot of support politically.
I understand.
Is that really complicated to understand?
I think once you start pushing and explaining this piece, that piece, it becomes very clear to understand. But just at a surface, if you just scratch and sniff it, I can see why people don't get it. It's so complicated. All this stuff is so complicated, Larry. Nothing is simple anymore.
So, well, this thing with Joe Arpaio, the taxpayer is going to be paying for what he did for a long, long time. We don't know how many lawsuits may be working their way through the courts related to inmates that suffered health effects or maybe even died in his operative the way he operated the jails. We don't know any of that stuff. It may be Certainly. That they spend a whole lot of money above of what we're seeing now. But I put this in here just to let folks know, something that sounds good and makes you run out and vote for someone because you have an anger and this has a need to fill that void in your heart to get even with somebody. Joe R. Pyle will cost you folks in Maricopa County a lot of money.
Very good. Do you want to cover anything else before I talk about our new patrons?
No, I think we've had a great episode.
I agree. I want to definitely thank Mr. M for joining us. He came in at the whopping, well, I'm not even going to say, he came in at a very generous level. And then we also got a new one from John, and then also David, and then also Brandon increased his support of the program. I thank you all so very much. That's four either new or increasing patrons this month, which is fantastic. Thank you very much.
And I've also been watching the YouTube subscription rate go up.
Of course, because everyone listening should go subscribe to the podcast.
Even if you're not going to receive it by YouTube, it helps us get closer to that magic number.
Yes. Also, you should download it on the podcast app.
And what does that do? Because the YouTube, I understand that the algorithm of YouTube, the more people that click like, the more people who make a comment, the more people who subscribe, the more they've recommended out to the general audience around the country. What does the podcast, how does that work in terms of the similarity?
To me, it's independent media that I own the server essentially that is running the program, and that if you're downloading it directly, then you're getting it directly from the source. And YouTube could turn us off one day because they don't like that we're talking about PFR issues, and then our whole platform is gone. So it's just mostly spreading it out. Plus, you can listen to it in your car. It's hard to listen to YouTube in your car unless you pay for it, because once you turn off your screen, the audio stops.
All right.
There you go. Any snail mails? Excuse me. Any snail mail subscribers?
I don't think we have any new ones, but we're going to transition to a new distribution model. I've got a person who's going to actually produce the transcript after I do the proofing and editing and making the corrections. The person's going to handle the preparation and mailing and printing. So hopefully that'll take a little bit of load off of me, and then we're eventually going to find a new transcriptionist at some point.
Very good. Hey, if you want to do some transcription stuff and possibly get paid for doing it, reach out to us. RegistryMattersCast@gmail.com. And of course, find all the show notes over at registrymatters.co. And if you want to leave voicemail, 747-227-4477. RegistryMattersCast@gmail.com, like I just said. And for those who don't know, Patreon support is patreon.com/registrymatters. For as little as $1 a month, you can support the program and all the work that we're doing here. And it is so very much appreciated. And without anything else, Larry, I thank you very much for all the work that you do. And I will talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
Later.
You've been listening to FYP.